when communication would stall out completely. Since I was about the only thing they could ever agree on, I was in a unique position to help them paper over the rifts between them and get them talking again. Anne had refined her unique ability in the heat of similar action. I summarized what I'd heard her say. You have an ability to feel a certain kind of energy shift in the room and inside you, and tuning into this energy helps you know what to do. That's basically it, she said. I asked her if that ability showed up in other situations. I don't know, she said, but it's a good question, because if I can use that wherever I am, I'll always know I'm applying my very best part of me to the job. That's the payoff I'd like you to get. To do that, I recommend that you deconstruct that set of Russian dolls until you uncover the one that contains your unique ability. Begin with a fundamental statement like this. I'm at my best when I'm... And then fill in the blank with something that comes to mind. Let that statement resonate in your mind a few times, then speak it out loud. Discover what you come up with. Perhaps you come up with, I'm at my best when I'm generating ideas on a yellow legal pad, or I'm at my best when I'm figuring out how to put a team together. Just get a good general statement of what you're doing when you feel you're at your best. Once you've come up with a simple, clear statement of you at your best, go a little deeper. Use a statement like the following to zoom in for a closer look. When I'm at my best, the exact thing I'm doing is fill in the blank. Go for a more detailed description, such as, when I'm generating ideas on a yellow legal pad, the exact thing I'm doing is doodling and enjoying the feeling of creating something out of nothing. Go even deeper with a sentence like this one. When I'm doing that, the thing I love most about it is, fill in the blank. For example, when I'm doodling and creating something out of nothing, the thing I love most is not knowing where it's going to take me. I love the surprise factor, the excitement of seeing what's going to emerge. You'll be able to know you're getting close to your unique ability when you feel an inner glow of wonder and excitement. Even though I've been with hundreds of people as they tapped into that feeling, I never feel blasé about it. There's something intrinsically enlivening about being with people when they're discovering this depth within themselves. Probably because the process is connected to my own genius, I can engage in it all day long and never get tired. And that's what I want for you. Living in your zone of genius. Using the ultimate success mantra to thrive in love, abundance, and creativity. Once you've broken free of your upper limit problem, your job is to learn to live in your zone of genius. It's at first a delicate tightrope walk, which then gets easier as you master the skills required to keep your balance in the new environment. Fortunately, there are shortcuts learned through the raw life experience of hundreds of people. These shortcuts can save you a great deal of time and trouble. I'll show you how to put them to work right now. Get out of the box and onto the spiral. There's a phrase I use in teaching people how to live in the zone of genius. Get out of the box and onto the spiral. And here's what I mean by it. I think of the zone of genius as a continuous spiral. You go higher and higher every day as you expand your capacity for more love, abundance, and success. It's an upward journey with no upper limit. By contrast, I think of the lower zones as boxes. For example, your zone of excellence is a space in which you know how to function so well that you can attain great results without stretching yourself very much. It's a box, though, because ultimately you find yourself stymied and unsatisfied within it. You're doing the same thing over and over, and while it feeds the people around you, it doesn't feed you. You need to get out of any boxes you're in so you can taste the sweet freedom of living on a continuous upward spiral. To do that, a central guiding intention comes in very handy. The ultimate success mantra, a central guiding intention. Navigating the upward reaches of a spiral is different from navigating around inside a box. I found that it called for a new set of skills. It took quite a few years of experimentation to refine those skills, but with time, I discovered a simple set of shortcuts that'll make your learning time much more efficient. The first shortcut is to organize your inner operating system around what I call a central guiding intention. The central guiding intention is a metaprogram I want you to install at the root or source of your being. I want you to store it alongside other essential metaprograms, such as relating to gravity and eating when hungry. Your central guiding intention will help you live easefully in your zone of genius. The central guiding intention for living in your zone of genius is what I call the ultimate success mantra. Before I show you the ultimate success mantra, let me explain a few key things about how mantras work. A mantra is a sound or idea that you use as a focal point in meditation. In some meditation systems, the mantra is a word or sound from an ancient language such as Sanskrit or Hebrew. In other systems, it might be an idea, such as focus your awareness on your breathing. I've received instruction in many different forms of meditation, and regardless of whether the practice comes from Buddhist, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, or other sources, the mantra is usually employed the same way. First, you focus your attention on the mantra. Then, when your attention wanders, you return your attention to the mantra. The mantra gives you a home base to come back to whenever you notice that your mind has taken an excursion into the past or the future. The mantra is designed to help you return to the present moment. For example, if you're using Om as your mantra, you repeat Om lightly in your mind. After some repetitions, your mind will naturally wander. When you notice that it's wandered, you let go of the thoughts and return to repeating Om. In Buddhist practices such as Zen and Vipassana meditation, breath awareness is often used as the mantra. You focus your awareness on the sensations of your breathing. Then, when you notice that your attention has wandered off into other thoughts, you gently return your awareness to your breathing. I've been on meditation retreats in which we meditated up to 14 hours a day. In my daily life, I do a much more modest practice of half hour in the morning and half hour in the evening. In 14 hours of meditation, or even a half hour, your mind will wander and then return to the mantra hundreds of times. The art of meditation is in the way you let go of your wander thoughts and return to the mantra. Specifically, the art is in letting go of the wander thoughts and returning to the mantra without giving yourself a hard time about wandering. It's common in the beginning stages of meditation to criticize yourself when your mind wanders, to think of meditation as a conflict between your mantra and your wander thoughts. As your practice matures, though, you usually realize that criticizing yourself for your mind's wandering is just another thought. You let go of it and return to the mantra. Gradually, the habit of self-criticism disappears and is replaced by an open-hearted feeling of self-acceptance. That's a key to how I want you to use the Ultimate Success Mantra, or USM. In a moment, I'll explain the USM and give you formal instructions for putting it to work in your life. As we get into more details, though, let me emphasize that in all your experiences with the USM, your key to integrating it smoothly and effectively into your life is to be gentle and open-hearted with yourself. With that in mind, let's proceed to the specifics. The USM is a comprehensive intention you'll use to center yourself in your zone of genius. It's a set of instructions to your conscious and unconscious mind designed to inform all your actions and decisions. If you use the USM as instructed, your life will gradually conform to the comprehensive intention contained with it. Here's the USM. I expand in abundance, success, and love every day as I inspire those around me to do the same. Begin to work with the USM right now in the following way. Say it over a few times in your mind, savoring the comprehensive idea that lives within it. Whisper it to yourself in the quiet of your mind. Let it resonate in the vast reaches of your consciousness. Now, discover how it resonates in your spoken tones. Say it out loud a few times, listening to the resonance of the words as well as the idea itself. Later, I'll invite you to modify it, if you wish, to your own preferences. Slip into the ultimate success mantra and take it for an experimental walk in your consciousness. It's the product of more than 3 decades of refinement with several thousand people, so I know it works wonders with a broad range of successful people. However, that's no guarantee you're going to resonate with it. The only way you'll find that out is through giving it a thorough tryout in your own consciousness. Here's what the ultimate success mantra does for you on a moment-by-moment basis. It beams an instruction to your conscious and unconscious mind. It tells you to expand rather than contract or remain as is in 3 key areas of your development: abundance, love, and success. The USM directly counters the upper limit problem, which is based on instructions from long ago to contract or to hold yourself in check. The USM is the antidote to years of conditioning, that ancient programming that convinced your unconscious mind you don't deserve full success. I want you to mount a gentle but unstoppable offensive against that conditioning. And the ultimate success mantra is the best way I've found to do that. How to use the ultimate success mantra. I recommend you use the USM in 2 specific ways, formally as a meditation practice and informally as you go about your daily life. The USM is very powerful, so a little bit of it goes a long way. You don't need to rent a cave in Tibet or devote years to the practice. All you need to do is slip the USM into your thought stream from time to time and watch the magic unfold in your life. To use the USM as a formal meditation, find a place where you can sit quietly for 5 to 10 minutes. Close your eyes and rest for a minute or two until your system settles down. Once every 15 to 20 seconds, whisper the USM softly to yourself. Say the words quietly in your mind, like a faint thought. You don't need to pronounce the words distinctly as long as you can feel the concept of the USM. It will go like this. Whisper the USM softly to yourself. It takes me 5 to 7 seconds to do this. Then pause and rest with an open mind for 10 to 15 seconds. That's about the time it takes for 2 slow, easy breaths. Then whisper the USM softly to yourself again. Then pause and rest with an open mind for about 10 to 15 seconds. Continue doing that for 5 to 10 minutes. When you feel you're at a good stopping place, pause and rest for a minute or two before returning to your normal activities. Here's what to expect. The 10 to 15 seconds of pause and rest with an open mind are just as important as saying the USM. You need to give your conscious and unconscious mind a few moments of open space in which to digest this powerful new idea. You also need to give yourself room to bring forth what I call backtalk from your old programming. Backtalk is what occurs when your old programming argues with the beautiful new idea you're beaming into the depths of yourself. Think about it for a moment. You say the USM to yourself. I expand in abundance, success, and love every day as I inspire those around me to do the same. And then a burst of mind chatter talks back at you with something like, "Forget it. You'll never inspire anybody to do anything worthwhile." Expect plenty of backtalk during those seconds after you've floated the USM through your mind. It's good to make room for the resistance that you, along with the rest of us, have to the powerful idea in the USM to surface. After all, you're overcoming decades of conditioning, and you can't expect that old programming to disappear into the void without a murmur. Actually, I want you not only to expect backtalk, but to encourage it. Backtalk is a good thing because it lets you know that the USM is working. The backtalk will stop once the USM has permeated your conscious and unconscious mind. Later, when you're firmly established in your zone of genius, you'll look back on your resistance like it was a backpack full of rocks you carried without realizing it. Once you take off the extra weight of the backpack, You'll feel so liberated you won't waste much time being concerned with the years you spent carrying it. Here's how to use the ultimate success mantra informally as an addition to your daily life. Occasionally throughout the day, float the USM through your mind or speak it out loud. Just slip it into your ordinary thought stream as you move through your day. I also recommend writing it out on 3x5 cards or sticky notes and posting it in various places where you'll see it during the day. I put it in places where I look often, such as the dashboard of my car or a corner of my desk. This will serve to remind you of it during the busy whirl of your day. Now let's talk about what I call the enlightened no, a key shortcut. As you learn to navigate the updrafts of the genius spiral, your flight will be smoother if you get nimble at what I call the enlightened no. You produce an enlightened no when you turn down something that doesn't fit into your zone of genius. I call it the enlightened no because you're saying no in the service of your genius. You're not saying no for all the usual reasons, such as money or dislike or lack of time and so forth. You're saying no because you've chosen to focus on activities that are clearly in your zone of genius. Saying no for that reason even has an inspirational effect on the people you're turning down. I frequently had people get in touch to thank me for the way I said no to them, because it inspired them to do the same thing in service of their own genius. I encourage you to look carefully at the number of times you say yes to things that do not fit in your zone of genius. Even if they seem beneficial for other reasons, those requests can eat up a great deal of energy that could be better invested in expressing your genius. Let me give you an example. A while back, I had a flurry of requests from a company that had invented several electronic devices that wanted me to endorse. I checked out the devices. They fit broadly into the category of biofeedback machines, and they did indeed appear to be useful. The company offered me $50,000 and some stock if I would give my endorsement. While on the surface it looked like easy money for endorsing something that could help people, I took some time to think it over. In discussing the matter with Kathleen, I got a great reminder of why for the past 29 years since I've met her, I've awakened every day feeling like the luckiest man on earth. She listened to my description of the gadgets and the company and the deal they were offering, and without blinking an eye, she asked, "Does it fit in your zone of genius?" The question took me so by surprise that I burst out laughing. "No," I said, "except maybe the $50,000 part." Well, here's where the magic of saying an enlightened no comes into play. I sent them an email that explained why I was turning them down. In part, it said, "I've been really benefiting in recent years from focusing on activities that are what I call my zone of genius. These are things that I'm uniquely suited to do and which serve my highest purposes for my life. While I like the people I've met from your company and while I think the devices are useful, I'm going to turn down your generous offer because it doesn't fit in the sweet spot of my zone of genius." About an hour after I sent that email, I got a call from the head of the company. He said something like, "You would not believe the discussion that came out of getting your email." He said that the executive team had already planned an off-site to focus on this topic for themselves. Would I be willing to hire myself out for the day to work with them on it? I told him I didn't have time to do that because I was firmly ensconced in my zone of genius every day, writing a book, the one that comes along with this audio for The Big Leap, a book that explained everything I knew about the subject. I said if he could be patient for 6 or 8 months, I'd be happy to send him a copy and we could talk about a seminar for his organization. Most opportunities to say an enlightened no don't come attached to something like compelling amounts of cash. It doesn't matter, though, because it's not about the cash value of the thing you're saying no to. It's about strengthening your commitment to living in your zone of genius. Each time you say an enlightened no to something that does not serve your genius, you build a stronger foundation for yourself in the zone. Now let's talk about another shortcut, renewing and refining commitment. Commitment works as a springboard to your zone of genius. The moment you make a sincere commitment to living in your zone of genius, you propel yourself in that direction. Once you're in the zone, commitment also works magnificently well as a steering mechanism and a calibration device to keep you centered there. Kathleen and I often say that the art of commitment should really be called the art of recommitment. Commitment gets you started and propels you through the early stages of any game, but it's recommitment that ignites your reserves when you feel like you're going to give up. Those moments of low energy are inevitable, in my experience at least, when you're on a quest for any worthy goal. The saving move in that moment is to renew your commitment. For example, during the course of your quest, you may come up against a deeply buried belief that you are fundamentally unlovable. Those beliefs tend to emerge in the hearts and minds of people as they progress toward permanent occupancy of their zone of genius. After all, what ultimate test could we set for ourselves but to mount a search for something we have already decided isn't available anywhere? It's nearly inevitable, then, that you will someday encounter a boulder in the living room of your zone of genius. That boulder is the belief that you are unlovable. This false belief fuels a frantic search for something external to yourself that confirms that you are indeed lovable. It's the ultimate trick by that ultimate trickster, your ego, to hold on to its job. It's an issue of job security, and your ego is incredibly dedicated to keeping its job. Your ego has every right to be scared, because it's on notice. In the zone of genius, you don't really have any need for your ego. In the zone of genius, you don't care about getting approval. You don't care about getting control. You don't care about getting even, or any of the other get-oriented goals of the ego. You're a free agent there, ready to respond to the infinite possibilities of this present moment. But when the war erupts between your conviction that love lies outside yourself and the deep knowledge that it's a matter of your own creation, you can feel a kind of cellular exhaustion that seems part of the very cosmos itself. And that's when recommitment comes in handy. It's time then to take a deep breath and renew your commitment to living full time in your zone of genius. Almost on a daily basis, I revisit the key commitments of my life in the zone of genius. I often speak and think my ultimate success mantra. I expand in abundance, success, and love every day as I inspire those around me to do the same. I move and breathe and hum with the mantra whenever I think of it, and I think of it often. It's become part of the fabric of my being now, as close to me as the feeling of my pulse or the sweet sensation of fresh air in my nostrils. Living in the zone of genius is like riding a bicycle. It's not that hard once you get the hang of it. In fact, it's deliciously easy and a source of the onrushing exhilaration that gives human life its best intensity. It exacts a stern requirement, though, that's best not to argue with. You've got to pay exquisite attention. I have a few scars on my hide from not honoring that requirement. When I hit a wobbly spot on the journey, I seize the moment to make a recommitment. From time to time, you'll probably lose focus and your attention will wander. It comes with the territory. When it happens, though, it doesn't need to be a big deal. It simply means that you need to recommit to what you've chosen to be here for, which is expressing your genius in the world in ways that help you and others thrive. Paying close attention will keep you centered and on track in the zone of genius. If you're paying attention, you'll notice when you've slipped out of your commitment to living in your zone. You'll feel off-center, perhaps, or nothing will seem to be going right. Then it's time to recommit and keep on moving. There are two high motivations for paying such close attention. First off, it's highly motivating to feel the kind of exhilaration every moment brings you when you're expanding in love, abundance, and success. You're motivated to keep living in the zone of genius because it feels so exhilarating. Beyond that, though, there's a special elixir brewed by mixing exhilaration with serenity. The serenity comes from the second part of your ultimate success mantra, to inspire those around you to live in their zone of genius. Inspiring others is often touted as a moral imperative, a should, and a duty, but very few people ever speak to the sensual delights of inspiration. One of the most delicious feelings in the world comes from seeing people actually becoming inspired by your commitment to living in your zone of genius. Not only is inspiring others good for the others, it feels wonderful to you, too. Now let's talk about living in Einstein time, creating time for the full expression of your genius. For your life to work harmoniously, you need to develop a harmonious relationship with time. Most people have a difficult time balancing all of their priorities, and there is no greater priority than transforming your relationship with time. If you get a handle on how time actually operates, your work flows gracefully and at high performance. If you don't, it doesn't. Before I figured out how time actually works, I put in twice as many hours and got half as much done. Everything changed when I figured out the secret of Einstein time. Now I work half as much and get at least twice as much done. Even though I understand the science behind that shift, it still seems like a miracle to me. One immediate payoff of getting the correct understanding of time is that you feel less stressed as you go through your day. That's good, but there's an even bigger reward. You free up time for creative thinking. When I give speeches to executive groups such as the Young President's Organization, I hear one complaint more than any other. The complaint goes like this. We don't have time to do the creative thinking that makes the biggest difference in our business. In business as well as life itself, it's easy to get so bogged down in handling details that you don't have time to make new creative breakthroughs. If you put these ideas to work for you, you will not have that problem anymore. When you make the shift to Einstein time, you experience a major surge in your productivity, creativity, and enjoyment. The shift takes place the moment you embrace one profoundly simple truth, and here it is. You are where time comes from. Embrace and embody this truth, and you can experience a quantum jump in productivity and free time. It works so well it may seem like magic, but it's based on solid science inspired by Einstein's physics. Once you understand that you are where time comes from, you have the power to make as much of it as you want. You're the boss. I know that might sound strange, but I promise you that this is the way time actually works. Before I started teaching this concept to others, I learned it myself, the hard way. About 20 years ago, in a period of great frustration and stress, I discovered that most of my stress and frustration occurred because I had time all wrong. My conception of time was so skewed that I felt either rushed, like having not enough time, or bored, like having too much of it. Most of the time I felt rushed, as if there was never enough time and it was constantly slipping away from me. I never got all the things done that I needed to do, even though I felt like I was working overtime. To escape the distress I was feeling, I took a 3-day walkabout in the Rocky Mountain wilderness. I thought that perhaps a few days of dealing with fundamentals such as thunderstorms, pumas, and such would clear my mind. On the last day of my trip, as I perched on a boulder overlooking a flowing mountain brook, I had a realization that changed my life and gave me my serenity back. I saw that my understanding of time was based on an outmoded Newtonian paradigm. In that flash of insight, I realized that Einstein's paradigm was the way time actually worked. I felt a shift of consciousness inside me. My cells seemed to rearrange themselves around the new understanding. Everything changed in that moment, and from that day until now, I've gotten everything done in half the time and had a great time doing it. As a result, I haven't felt rushed in 20 years. Looking at this from the outside, my life is much busier now than when I had my big insight. In spite of that, I never feel hurried. You don't need a mountain walkabout to bring this awareness into play. After he heard me talk about Einstein time at a seminar, a Manhattan stockbroker sent me an email telling me about what had happened recently on his daily subway ride to Wall Street. He said that he was running late one morning and had sprinted to catch the train, trying to balance a cup of coffee, a bagel, and his briefcase. Jammed in with the other riders on the crowded train, he started to look at his watch but couldn't raise his arm because he was wedged in so tightly between people. He felt a wave of panic building because he couldn't see what time it was or assess how late he was going to be for the meeting. Suddenly he recalled our conversation about Einstein time. Wait a minute, he thought. I am time. I'm where it comes from, and I'll make enough of it so I won't be late for my meeting. He relaxed his body and tried to focus on enjoying the moment in spite of his wedged-in state. Since he didn't have to worry about falling over, he just closed his eyes and put his attention on being just where he was. Soon he reached his destination and walked out into the crisp morning air. Again he felt the urge to look at his watch, and again he let the urge pass. When he got to the meeting that he expected to be late for, nobody was in the room yet. He sat down alone and relished the at-ease feeling in his body. Soon people began streaming in, full of complaints about late trains and buses, slow-moving lines and coffee shops and such. He just smiled. Now I invite you to make the bold move of changing to Einstein time. If you're using any time management system, put it in a drawer and don't look at it again. In reality, you probably haven't been using it much anyway. Einstein time is a new kind of time management that reorganizes your conception of time at the very core. It doesn't take any time at all to use it. In fact, it generates time while also producing abundant rewards in creativity, feelings of ease, and financial well-being. This new way of being with time delivers four main benefits. You get more done in less time. You enjoy plenty of time and abundant energy for your most important creative activities. You discover your unique abilities and how to express them. And you feel good inside. Let's take a close look at this problem that we all face. Along with millions of other busy people, you probably have thought about time quite a bit. You probably have purchased one or more of the time management systems, such as the Franklin Covey system or the one that my neighbor David Allen created. At first, you probably had the highest intentions of using it faithfully. However, after the class ended and the consultant departed, you tried to use the system but struggled with its complexity. Eventually, if you used it at all, you kept a small part of it and quit using the rest. You may have even felt guilty that you didn't use it to its full advantage. Then, sometime later, you probably bought another one. I don't want you to feel bad about this. You're in good company, mine for one. Before I figured out the secret of time, I probably studied or bought half a dozen different systems. Give yourself some appreciation for making the noble effort. Your original intention was to solve one of the most difficult problems in modern life, which is how to get everything done you need to do and still have time for creativity, family, and yourself. This noble intention causes millions of people every year to invest in time management systems, only to find that they stop using them or that the systems consume more time than they save. Einstein time gives you a way to expand the amount of time you have for creative expression and intimate connections. With Einstein time, you not only save time, you'll learn how to become the source of time so you can make as much of it as you want. With Einstein time, you'll also discover how to liberate the energy you need for accomplishing your most precious activities. You'll understand exactly what drains your creative energy and how to stop the drain. The result is this: no more rushing, no more time pressure, no more feeling exhausted because you worked all day and didn't get any of the important things done. Instead, you have plenty of time, an abundance of energy, and the skills that will keep both time and energy in a constant state of refreshing renewal. There's no evidence that the pace of life will ever become slower in the future. We need ways to organize our time and energy, but the existing systems of time management are useful only up to a point and only with certain types of people. For most of us, and especially for creative people, Einstein time delivers a unique set of benefits. It's simple to understand, easy to implement, and so useful you'll wonder how you ever did without it. Now it's time to slip out of the time trap you've been caught in so you can soar into the open spaces of your zone of genius. While it's possible to make improvements in your work and personal life by applying a Newtonian approach to time, you need to make an Einsteinian shift in order to experience a genuine liberation from time constraints. At best, a Newtonian approach gives us incremental improvements. What we really need, though, is radical transformation, and that's where Einstein's paradigm comes into play. The old Newtonian paradigm of time is also its major limitation. The Newtonian view says that there's only a finite amount of time, and it must be carefully portioned out so there'll be enough of it to do the things that we need to do. It's exactly the same problem we would have if we assumed there was a scarcity of food. We'd always be hungry, and we'd always be afraid there wasn't enough food available. If you've ever thought that way about time, welcome to a very large club. There's hope, however, because while the Newtonian view is where most of us start, it is not how time actually works. Newtonian time scarcity is just a stage we're passing through, just as Newtonian physics was a stage we passed through on the way to Einstein's breakthrough. The Newtonian paradigm guarantees that you'll always have a problem with time. You'll either have too little of it or too much. You'll either have no time at all, or you'll be sitting around with time on your hands. You'll be rushing to catch up or bored out of your wits. In the Newtonian world, we're either running out of time or watching the seconds creep by. Think of how many times in your life you've heard someone say, "I have exactly the right amount of time to enjoy everything I'm doing." I don't believe I've ever heard anybody say anything like that. Most people seem to be living at the two extremes of the time continuum, either rushing to stay ahead of the clock because they're so busy, or virtually brain dead with boredom because they don't have enough to do. At the heart of the Newtonian time crunch is a dualistic split. We're deluded into thinking that time is out there, an actual physical entity that can put pressure on us in here. That's ridiculous, of course, but try to tell that to a patient in a cardiologist's office. As Meyer Friedman, M.D., pointed out in his classic book, Type A Behavior in Your Heart, typical heart patients have a marked sense of time urgency. They're in a race with time, and their hearts show the wear and tear of it. Newtonian dualism pits us against time. In this paradigm, we think of time as the master and us as its slave. At the extreme, time becomes our persecutor and we think of ourselves as its victim. Since time feels like an ever-present entity hovering in the background of our lives, we come to feel that we're victims of an entity that's always there all the time. Such a view is dangerous to our health, disastrous for our business, and ruinous to our relationships with family and friends. That's why I urge you to adopt Einstein time. Not only is it a new paradigm, it can literally be a lifesaver. Here's the Newtonian time trap in detail. To get to the new expanded version of time offered by Einstein, we also need to make a few changes in how we think about space. When we're running on Einstein time, our experience of time changes because we make a fundamental change in how much space we're willing to occupy. By learning to occupy space in a new way, we actually gain the ability to generate more time. Here's a practical example. Recall Einstein's colloquial explanation of relativity, how an hour with your beloved feels like a minute, and a minute on a hot stove feels like an hour. This example has everything you need to understand Einstein time and its powerful positive ramifications for how we live our lives. If you're forced to sit on a hot stove, you become preoccupied with trying not to occupy the space you're in. You withdraw your consciousness toward your core, contracting away from the pain of contact with the stove. The act of contracting your awareness away from space makes time congeal. It seems to slow down and harden into a solid mass. The more you cringe from the pain, the slower time gets. When you're embracing your beloved, though, your awareness flows in the opposite direction toward space. When you're with your beloved, every cell in your body yearns to be in union with him or her. Your awareness flows out toward the periphery. You want to occupy every possible smidgen of space in the yearned-for present. When you're in love, you relax into the space around you and in you, and as your consciousness expands into space, time disappears. If you even remember to glance at a clock, you notice that time has leaped forward in great spurts. Entire hours can disappear in the wink of an eye. When your heart is beating in time with your beloved's, your every cell is reaching out for total union. You forget about time. When you're willing to occupy all space, time simply disappears. You're everywhere all at once. There's no place to get to, and everywhere you are, it's exactly the right time. Now back to the stove. I hope it's been a long time since you've sat on one, so let's use an example that's probably more relevant to your daily life. Let's say you notice that your belly muscles are particularly tight on a given morning. You're busy, though, so you don't stop to find out why your stomach's so tight. In other words, you choose not to occupy the space of your tense belly by shining the light of awareness on it. You ignore it and hurry on. This is a costly moment, though, because by choosing not to become aware of why your belly muscles are so tight, you sentence yourself to a day-long battle with time. Specifically, let's say your belly is tight because you're scared. Let's say you're scared about a visit from your daughter, as recently happened to a friend of mine. He's a single dad whose wife died from cancer several years ago, leaving him with three teenage daughters to raise on his own. Here's the story he told me. About 9 a.m., I was sitting at my desk working on an article I needed to finish that day. The phone rang. It was my 19-year-old daughter, Sarah, calling from a phone booth. She said she was on her way home from her college, which was a 6-hour drive away. She told me she needed to talk to me about something important. It was too important to talk about on the phone. My belly clenched into a tight fist when I heard that. I begged her to give me a hint, but she simply said she'd see me in the afternoon. She hung up without even saying goodbye. The conversation was so unlike our usual way of communicating that I felt dumbfounded. I actually stood there staring at the phone in my hand for a long moment before I remembered to hang it up. Then I entered a time tunnel for the next 6 hours. I must have looked at the clock 1,000 times. I would try to concentrate on my article, but my mind would wander back to the conversation. Sarah had always been the responsible one, so my mind was jumping through hoops trying to imagine what was going on. Was she pregnant? Had she caught some dread disease? By 3 p.m., my mind felt it was like on a high-speed setting of a Cuisinart. Finally, Sarah walked in, and I said, "Where have you been?" She said she'd stopped for lunch, and the restaurant had been jammed. "Lunch," I croaked. The idea of eating during the past 7 hours had been unthinkable to me. So what had brought her home? She told me that halfway through her school year, the full force of grief about her mother's death had descended upon her. She found she didn't want to be there. She wanted to postpone school until the following year, get a temporary job, maybe do some traveling that summer. She was deeply worried that I would feel disappointment and disapproval. She wanted to be able to see my face when she talked to me about the issue. 10 minutes later, we were laughing and crying together, best friends again. He told me that before she walked in the door, time had seemed slow as molasses. The minutes crept by, as they will when you look at the clock often. His creative energy disappeared also. No matter how much he tried to busy himself with his work, his mind kept returning to the knot in his belly and the worries in his mind. Suddenly, though, when Sarah shared her dilemma and her desires, time took on a different characteristic. An hour or two flew by as they talked about their feelings about her quitting college. Here's the real Einsteinian magic at work, though. When he sat back down to work on his article, his fingers flew over the keyboard, and he finished his project in less than an hour. He thought it would take all day to write it, but instead it took a fraction of that time. Here's the truth about time and all the things you really don't want to do. You'll never have enough money to buy all the stuff you don't really need, and you'll never have enough time to do all the things you really don't want to do. Our Newtonian concept of both time and money is built on scarcity. The advertising industry thrives on the fact that they know this, and most of us don't. Advertising encourages us to want a lot of things we don't really need. It also encourages us to want to do a lot of things we don't really want to do. All those problems disappear on Einstein time. To get on Einstein time, you have to make one big shift, and it's so unthinkable that I've actually heard grown-ups gasp in astonishment when I've suggested they do it. It involves taking full ownership of time. It's such a bold step that very few people have the courage to take it. I'm betting you're one of those few, though. Stay with me here. The concept is so unusual that it can't be understood in the usual way. We have to peel off layers of old, erroneous programming in order to get to the elegant, simple truth of it. One layer that needs to be peeled off is your time persona. So let me ask you, pardon me, may I borrow your persona for a moment? You see, part of our problem with time is related to the persona we have. A persona is a pattern of actions and feelings that came into being at a certain time in our lives in response to certain conditions. Persona, a Latin word that means mask, is the root of our more familiar word, personality. Think back on the different personas you saw around you in your family of origin. The same family can produce one child who wears a rebel persona, another child with a mom's helper persona, and a third with a class clown persona. Where and how those personas form is one of the great mysteries that the field of psychology tries to solve. We're going to leave that mystery for the academics right now, though. Here I want to focus only on the most practical aspect of personas. Here's what you really need to know about your persona. Everybody's got at least one persona, and most of us have two or three we wear for different occasions. Here's the quirky truth that gets overlooked. Most of us probably don't realize that the persona we're wearing is actually a persona. For example, if you've been wearing a shy kid persona since you were in kindergarten, as an adult, you may actually think you're shy. You may not realize that it's like a suit you put on early in life and have been wearing so long you think it's your skin. Part of becoming a grown-up is learning to spot when we're operating out of a persona. Part of growing up is discarding the personas that aren't contributing to our happiness and success in life. The rebel may wake up at age 25 and realize that the same amount of effort it takes to rebel against authority can be rechanneled into getting positive attention from authorities. I know, I'm one of them. I got in trouble a lot in high school, college, and elsewhere, often for the antics of my class clown persona. I realized in my 20s that much of my rebel persona came from trying to get attention from male authority figures. I'd grown up without a father, and I believe I hid my grief about that issue under a layer of anger. It took an upside-down approach in my interactions with authority, getting the attention I craved through misbehavior rather than through positive contributions. It worked out okay in the long run because I woke up in time to turn that rebel energy into creative energy. Time personas work the same way. Most of us adopt a persona in regard to time, and then we forget it's a persona. We lose sight of the fact that we can take it on and off. It becomes ingrained and semi-permanent. Let me give you two examples of time personas from opposite ends of the spectrum. At one end, there's the time cop, who gets there on time and reminds others to do the same. The time cop gets frustrated because people don't show up on time, and gets particularly furious with those folks at the other end of the spectrum, the time slackers. If you wear the time slacker persona, you're always getting hassled for being late or not showing up at all. If you're a time cop, you're often hassling people for not keeping their time agreements. I will insert a forthright confession here. I am a time cop. This persona has softened a little bit as I've matured, but once a time cop, always a time cop. I expect that this persona will be with me until my last breath, which will be on time, I can assure you. I had an employee for a while who was a classic time slacker. Wherever she was supposed to be, she was always a little late. Most of the time it didn't cause problems, because her duties around the office were not usually time-sensitive. One time, however, it caused a big problem. Her sole duty on a particular day was to pick me up at the airport at a certain time. I got to the curb outside the airport where she had assured me she would be, and she wasn't there. This was in the era before cell phones were common, so I had no way to find out if she was on her way or had forgotten about it completely. I waited around for a few minutes in the cold, then gave up and got into a cab. Back at the office an hour later, she came in and glared at me. "Where were you?" she asked. "I waited at the airport for half an hour." I could hardly believe my ears. "Where were you?" I asked. "I stood around waiting for 10 minutes, then had to take a $25 cab ride home." She gave me a classic time slacker answer. "Well, I was only 15 minutes late," she said, delivering this line with a tone of exasperated victimhood. I asked her, "Well, how was I supposed to know that you were only going to be 15 minutes late? For all I knew, you'd forgotten about it completely." She rolled her eyes, as in, "How can you possibly be so uptight?" It was a classic clash of the time personas, my time cop versus her time slacker. In this case, the time cop was the one who was providing the paychecks, so my persona carried the day. Two little words suggested themselves to me. I paused to roll them around in my mind, savoring their sweetness, then spoke them to her. "You're fired," I said. She was liberated from the bonds of my time cop persona, free to go slack on somebody else. When we switch to Einstein time, we take charge of the amount of time we have. We realize that we're where time comes from. We embrace this liberating insight. Since I'm the producer of time, I can make as much of it as I need. By getting the truth of this statement, we make a major adjustment in ourselves. We heal the dualistic split embedded in the Newtonian relationship with time. We're no longer in an us versus them relationship with time. We're the source of time, and by realizing that fact, we become the truth of it. It takes practice and keen awareness to master this concept. I'll show you how to make the most of your practice and what to focus your awareness on. If all this sounds mysterious and elusive, just remember, so did driving a car before you could do it. When I first sat in the driver's seat as a kid, I was sure I could never figure out all those complicated moves. I did, though, and you did too. If you can do that, you can master Einstein time. It's like driving, but with no car. I'll be blunt here, just as blunt as when I'm confronting limitations in my own mind. Quit thinking time is out there. Take ownership of time, acknowledge that you are where it comes from, and it will stop owning you. Claim time as your own, as yours, and it will release its claim on you. The best way I've found to do that is to become nimble at asking a specific question. The question allows you to seize the controls of your time and your life. There's no trick to the process. You could probably take ownership of time without the question simply by claiming time as yours to invent as you wish. You could do it by saying something to yourself like, "I acknowledge that I'm the source of time." You could look in the mirror and say, "I'm where time comes from." Or if you're one of those folks who like to lecture themselves sternly, you could say, "There's no such thing as time out there, meathead. It all comes from inside you. You are not time's victim." However, the question makes it simple and easy. So here it is. To generate an abundance of time, ask yourself this. Where in my life am I not taking full ownership? Another way to ask it is, what am I trying to disown? Or, what aspect of my life do I need to take full ownership of? The issue is always blindingly obvious, but we can't see it until we get humble enough to ask the question. Here's the principle behind the question. Stress and conflict are caused by